You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, everyone. My name is Wesley Livesay from the History of the Second World War podcast. Join me on a journey through the most destructive conflict in human history, a journey that will take us not just through the famous campaigns and cataclysmic battles, but also to the lesser well-known corners of the war that touched millions all over the world, as we try and answer not just the questions of what and where, but how and why. You can find History of the Second World War on all major podcast platforms or at historyofthesecondworldwar.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 6 of our Civil War podcast. My name is Rich, and here in the recording studio with me is my co-host. Her name is Tracy.
Hello y'all, and the recording studio is really our kitchen.
Well, yes, but that's just so we can be in close proximity to various snack items in case there's a, immediate need for a snack.
During the podcast?
You never know when you may have a snack emergency, Tracy.
Okay. Well, previously on the podcast, we covered the start of America's war with Mexico in 1846. We talked about how the war was connected to the United States' annexation of Texas and to the concept of manifest destiny.
And to the evil designs lurking in James K. Polk's dark little expansionist heart.
Rich.
Okay.
Anyway, we also talked about the start of hostilities in April 1846 between the Mexican Army and the American soldiers in Texas under the command of General Zachary Taylor.
Right. And it's important to remember that the force which Taylor took to Texas was composed of infantry, cavalry, and artillery units from the regular army. That means those soldiers, both enlisted men and officers, were professionals. Being in the army was their occupation. It's what they did for a living, right? But then the complexion of the war changed quite dramatically in mid to late 1846, when large numbers of American volunteer units started to show up for the fight with Mexico. As we mentioned at the close of the last show, after hostilities had commenced, Congress authorized the raising of thousands of volunteers, all of whom Congress authorized to be signed up for 12 months of military service.
Large numbers of volunteers were needed because the regular U.S. Army was a relatively small force, which reflected the American people's traditional mistrust of large standing armies, like they had in Europe, for instance. So raising this volunteer force for the war with Mexico would continue the American tradition of the citizen soldier, which went back to the Revolutionary War. These citizen soldiers were men, civilians, who would put on a uniform and take up arms to fight. But then when the danger was over, they'd take off the uniform, lay down their weapons, and go back to their civilian lives.
Yeah, and of course, this idea of the American citizen soldier still lives on into the present day, since today we still have National Guard and Reserve units that can be called up to serve in a conflict. And while we're on the topic, if you're listening to the podcast and are serving in the U.S. military, or if you're a veteran, we just want to give you a special shout out and say thank you for your service.
And stay safe.
Definitely. Okay, so back to the war with Mexico. And the volunteers back then may have signed up for glory and adventure, but mostly what they found was swarms of flies, heat, dust, boredom, snakes, tarantulas, scorpions, fleas and lice, and sickness and disease. Now, as was true with any war back in the olden days, during the Mexican War, sickness and disease, mostly from unsanitary camp conditions, caused many more deaths than did enemy bullets or shells. In fact, during the war with Mexico, about 1,700 Americans would die in battle, while about 10,000 are thought to have died from disease.
Most infantrymen on both the Mexican and American sides were armed with muzzle-loading flintlock smoothbore muskets. One American volunteer unit in particular, though, was armed with Model 1841 percussion cap rifles. This unit was the Mississippi Rifles under the command of a West Point graduate and member of Congress named Jefferson Davis. For those of you who have read ahead in the story, you know that Davis will serve as the first and only president of the Confederate States of America.
So last week, we talked about Zachary Taylor and his force of regulars down on the Rio Grande, which was where hostilities commenced. But once the war actually got rolling, there would be action on several different fronts. So what we'll do is cover each of those, and then come back to Zachary Taylor, and then finally circle back around to what turned out to be the decisive operation of the war, which was Winfield Scott's march on Mexico City. Sound good? All right. So first, out west in California, that expedition under Captain John C. Fremont that we mentioned in the last episode, it moved on Monterey in March 1846, even before hostilities commenced down on the Rio Grande. But Fremont's small band was thwarted by a Mexican force with artillery. Meanwhile, a group of American settlers in Sonoma decided to take matters into their own hands and declared that they were rebelling against the Mexican government. They established the short-lived California Republic. The Republic's flag sported a single star and the crude image of a grizzly bear, hence the fact that they were called the Bear Flag Republic.
Fremont revealed himself to be something of a loose cannon when he resigned his commission in the Army and then basically assumed command of the brand new Bear Flag Republic, saying his intention was to conquer all of California. Keep in mind that Fremont was doing all of this even though he had no idea whether or not the U.S. and Mexico were actually at war. At the same time, American naval officers in the region had heard rumors that the British Navy was ready to move in and occupy Monterey. So even though they also had no idea whether or not the U.S. and Mexico were actually at war, the officers decided to beat the British to the punch. And so in July 1846, U.S. naval forces seized Monterey. When Fremont and his merry band rode into Monterey and joined up with the American military force there, the short-lived Bear Flag Republic ceased to exist.
Then in August, the Americans occupied Los Angeles. A few days later, a ship arrived there with the news that war had been declared between the United States and Mexico several months before.
With the ways we can instantly communicate today, it's hard to remember how slowly news traveled back then.
I know. It's hard to imagine living in a world like that. But anyway, that's the way it was. But when Commodore Robert F. Stockton finally received the news that America and Mexico were at war, he issued a proclamation that California now belonged to the United States.
After war broke out, President Polk wanted to grab as much Mexican territory as possible, so he ordered that Colonel Stephen W. Kearny was to lead a force from Fort Leavenworth in the Kansas Territory and march overland to the city of Santa Fe in the Mexican province of New Mexico. After securing New Mexico for the United States, Kearny was to continue on to California before winter, if he could. Kearny's hard-marching column, some 1,700 men strong, mostly Missouri volunteers, arrived at Bent's Fort, about 60 miles north of Santa Fe, at the end of July 1846. Kearny managed to convince the local population that he had peaceful intentions, even as he left no doubt that his force was capable of crushing any resistance the New Mexicans were capable of raising. It turns out the locals weren't all that happy with the distant Mexican government anyway, and so Kearny was able to subdue the province without firing a shot.
Kearny then prepared to fulfill the second part of his mission and continue on to California before winter. He set off with his regular army soldiers, 300 troopers of the 1st Dragoons. On October 6, 1846, they ran into the famous guide Kit Carson. Carson said that U.S. military forces had already pacified California, So Kearney decided to send most of his men back to Santa Fe and just continue on through the inhospitable terrain with a smaller, more manageable detachment. Kearney then convinced Kit Carson to turn around and guide his small force into California. On November 23rd, that small force of Americans intercepted a Mexican messenger bearing dispatches that said California had risen up in revolt against its new American overlords. Well, this was certainly unwelcome news for Colonel Kearney. But Kearney pressed on, and along the way he was reinforced by several dozen American sailors and Marines who'd ridden out from San Diego to meet him. They were just in time to join Kearney's dragoons in the vicious little battle of San Pasqual. Pasqual was the only real battle of the California campaign, but it made up in ferocity what it lacked in size, since a third of Kearney's small force was either killed or wounded. After the battle had degenerated into a standoff, another, larger American relief force arrived on the scene and rescued Kearney, and so his battered little command was finally able to continue on to San Diego.
A few more skirmishes were fought, but the revolt quickly came to end, and the Americans once again settled in to occupy California. Meanwhile, New Mexico, after Kearney's departure, had risen up in bloody revolt after the American volunteers in Santa Fe acted like a bunch of ignorant yahoos. The unfortunate Charles Bent, the first governor of the territory, was killed in the violence, but after some sharp fighting in Taos, order was soon restored, and the New Mexicans rather resentfully resigned themselves to the American conquest of their province.
And then one final note before we leave the West. In July 1846, Company F of the U.S. Army's 3rd Artillery shipped out of New York City, bound for combat in far-off California. A lieutenant named William Tecumseh Sherman was one of the unit's half-dozen officers. Because this was, of course, the pre-Panama Canal era, the ship transporting the soldiers and their cannon had to go all the way around South America before it arrived in California late in January 1847, 6 months after leaving New York. So by the time the 3rd Artillery finally reached California, the fighting there was over, much to Lieutenant Sherman's dismay.
As battles raged in the far-off western territories and down south in Mexico, a different kind of conflict also erupted in Washington, D.C. On August 8, 1846, a freshman congressman from Pennsylvania named David Wilmot offered a proviso or limitation that would be attached to one of the first major spending authorizations for the Mexican War. The so-called Wilmot Proviso specified that slavery would not be permitted in any new lands the United States gained as a result of the war. It stated that, quote, as an express and fundamental condition to the acquisition of any territory from the Republic of Mexico, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall ever exist in any part of said territory, end quote.
Well, not surprisingly, the Southern congressional delegations erupted in rage at the Wilmot Proviso. And so, the issue of the expansion of slavery into new territories once again fractured Congress along sectional rather than party lines. Well, the proviso passed the House, where sheer northern numbers could guarantee victory, but it then failed in the Senate. In the Senate, Southerners had greater voting strength, since to their own numbers could always be added at least a few northern senators who would vote with them, whether to simply appease the Southerners or to safeguard the interests of northern textile mills that used southern cotton.
Despite this initial defeat in the summer of 1846, the proviso was subsequently introduced on one spending bill after another, each year of the war, much to the irritation of the southern congressional delegations. Each time it was introduced, the proviso won approval in the House, but then went down to defeat in the Senate.
In February 1847, our old friend, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, rose from his seat in the Senate and offered up a set of resolutions that spelled out his opinion that Congress, in its role as guardian of federal territories while those territories were ready to become states and join the Union, Congress, said Calhoun, had no right to ban the transportation of any citizen's property into those territories. Of course, since Southerners considered human slaves to be property, what Calhoun was saying was that Congress had no right to restrict the spread of slavery into any territory. By Calhoun's logic, this not only affected any new land gained from the war with Mexico, but it also would repudiate the agreement reached in the Missouri Compromise, since that arrangement banned the transportation of slaves to some of the territories. Well, messing with the Missouri Compromise was dangerous stuff indeed, but it delighted the Southern congressional delegations, who had been exasperated to no end by the Wilmot Proviso. But during this period, during the war with Mexico, neither Calhoun nor Wilmot was able to get his way, and so the frustrating, seemingly never-ending battle over the extension of slavery continued inconclusively in Congress. On April 15, 1846, the Boston Whig newspaper said that the Wilmot Proviso, quote, as if by magic, brought to a head the great question which is about to divide the American people, end quote.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
History isn't black and white, yet too often it's presented as such. Grey History, The French Revolution is a long-form history podcast dedicated to exploring the ambiguities and nuances of the past. By contrasting both the experiences of contemporaries and the conclusions of historians, Grey History dives into the detail and unpacks one of the most important and disputed events in human history, from a revolution based on hope and liberty to its descent into the infamous Reign of Terror. There's plenty to discuss and plenty of grey to explore. One can't understand the modern world without understanding the French Revolution. So if you're looking for your next long-form, binge-worthy history podcast, one recommended by universities and loved by enthusiasts, then check out Grey History, The French Revolution today, or simply search for The French Revolution.
Now we'll leave the halls of Congress and get back to the shooting war down in Mexico again. President Polk had decided the war needed to be carried to Mexico City, and so he sounded out Taylor on the practicality of marching overland from the Rio Grande. Taylor advised the president that the 1,000-mile march this would entail was not at all feasible with an army of any size. Taylor suggested his operations be limited to Mexico's northern provinces. Polk then decided that the Americans would do well to open a second front in Mexico's south, from which point Mexico City could be more directly threatened. The natural choice for commander of this operation was the General-in-Chief of the U.S. Army, Winfield Scott. And so, setting up shop at New Orleans, Scott set about shaping a horde of volunteers into an army he could land on the Gulf Coast of Mexico at the port of Veracruz.
While Winfield Scott was busy with those preparations at New Orleans, Zachary Taylor captured the provincial capital of Monterrey and then fought a Mexican force led by General Antonio López de Santa Anna near the Hacienda of Buena Vista. Now, to backtrack a bit, in 1845, when Santa Anna's political enemies seized power in Mexico City, they forced the flamboyant general, slash sometimes president, to go into exile on the island of Cuba. But in May 1846, the wily Santa Anna managed to convince American officials that he would earnestly work for peace between his homeland and the U.S. if the American Navy would only help facilitate his return to Mexico. And so the Commodore in charge of the American coastal blockade on Mexico's Gulf Coast then received orders to allow Santa Anna to slip back into his homeland. But once he was back in his own country, Santa Anna double-crossed the Americans and set about enthusiastically raising and equipping an army to defeat the American invaders.
Meanwhile, reinforced by thousands of volunteers, Taylor had decided to march inland and capture the Mexican city of Monterey.
Not the Monterey in California.
No, this Monterey is a provincial capital almost 190 miles due west of Matamoros, which we talked about in the last episode in connection with the action that was going on there along the Rio Grande.
Right. Well, this Monterey was a heavily fortified place, but in September 1846, Taylor's force fought a grueling three-day battle for control of the city, and then, after a short truce to work out the details of the city's surrender, the Mexican forces withdrew, and Monterey was occupied by Taylor's army on September 28th. James Longstreet, George Meade, and Braxton Bragg and his flying artillery were all with Taylor's army during the hard-fought battle for Monterey. And, during the fighting for the city, Colonel Jefferson Davis, leading his Mississippi Rifles, distinguished himself with his valor in some especially fierce combat during the storming of one of the city's key forts. Lieutenant Sam Grant's unit also happened to take part in the same attack on the city's forts. So in one of history's funny little ironies, Ulysses S. Grant and Jefferson Davis went into battle together that day in Mexico.
As part of Monterey's surrender, Taylor had agreed to a temporary armistice to last for 8 weeks. President Polk was outraged when he received news of this armistice. However, Taylor's victorious but worn-out army needed time to recover from the vicious fighting at Monterey. In October, General John E. Wool arrived with some regulars and volunteers from San Antonio to reinforce Taylor's army. Then in January 1847, an American officer was ambushed and killed, and the letter he was carrying made its way to Santa Anna. The message told Santa Anna that Taylor had been ordered to send his best soldiers to take part in Winfield Scott's landing at Veracruz. Indeed, by January 23rd, Taylor only had 500 regulars left, along with about 4,700 volunteers, most of who had yet to hear a shot fired in anger. After his return to Mexico, Santa Anna had raised an army of 20,000 men, and now, based on the priceless intelligence gained from the captured American letter, he planned to use this army to quickly move north, overwhelm Taylor, then turn back south and deal with Scott's invasion force.
After sending his best soldiers to Winfield Scott, Taylor was supposed to stay on the defensive, but he was loath to completely abandon his plans for subjugating Mexico's northern provinces, and so Taylor decided to probe forward with his much-reduced force. So when Santa Anna led his army north, the Mexican leader came upon an overextended and greatly outnumbered Taylor near the hacienda of Buena Vista.
On the night of February 20th, some bold Texas Rangers snuck up to the Mexican camp and started counting. Santa Anna had lost about 5,000 men on the grueling march northward, but that still left him with over 15,000 of Mexico's best soldiers. Zachary Taylor, after receiving the Texans' report, and now knowing he was about to face an attack by an overwhelming enemy force, resolved to make a desperate stand, and he entrusted Wool with the task of positioning the tiny American army on some strong defensive ground just south of Buena Vista.
After coming up to the American position chosen by Wool, Santa Anna, on February 22nd, 1847, sent a message to Taylor under a flag of truce. It read, "You are surrounded by 20,000 men and cannot in any human probability avoid suffering a rout and being cut to pieces with your troops. But as you deserve consideration and particular esteem, I wish to save you from this catastrophe and for that purpose give you this notice, in order that you may surrender at discretion, under the assurance that you will be treated with consideration belonging to the Mexican character, to which end you will be granted an hour's time to make up your mind, to commence from the moment when my flag of truce arrives in your camp.
At this point, we should probably take a moment to say that American military officers historically tend to react rather badly to surrender demands coming from arrogant enemy commanders.
Yeah, they do. And witnesses say Taylor reacted profanely when he read Santa Anna's message. But the note he sent back was actually quite restrained. It read, quote, "In reply to your note of this date, summoning me to surrender my forces at discretion, I beg leave to say that I decline acceding to your request." End quote. As you can probably tell, Zachary Taylor did not suffer fools gladly. George Meade described Taylor as, quote, "a plain, sensible old gentleman." End quote. Newspaper journalists had dubbed Taylor Old Rough and Ready, but his soldiers simply called him Old Zack.
In a letter home, an American officer wrote, quote, "Taylor is short and very heavy, with pronounced face lines and gray hair, wears an old oilcloth cap, a dusty green coat, a frightful pair of trousers, and on horseback looks like a frog," end quote. Taylor's horse was named Old Whitey, by the way.
Well, Old Zack apparently liked to lounge around camp in rumpled civilian clothes and bedroom slippers. And Taylor's soldiers loved to tell the story of a newly arrived shave-tail lieutenant who mistook the general for somebody's servant. The lieutenant offered the old fatty a dollar to clean his sword. And so Taylor sat down, polished the lieutenant's sword, and pocketed the dollar.
Anyway, that afternoon, after Old Zack refused the offer to surrender, Santa Anna launched an attack designed to turn the American left, the most vulnerable point of Taylor's line. But the Mexicans ran into withering fire from dismounted Arkansas and Kentucky riflemen. The fighting lasted until darkness covered the battlefield. After nightfall, Taylor, accompanied by the Mississippi Rifles and some dragoons, left for the rear to personally make sure his supplies and line of retreat were secure.
Across the way, frustrated that his initial strike had failed, Santa Anna spent the night positioning units to renew the attack on the American left and center on the morning of the 23rd. Taylor had left Wool in command, and Wool anticipated this move by Santa Anna, and so Wool reinforced that part of the American line. But despite this preventative action, when the Mexican assault burst upon the Americans that morning, it was overwhelming, and the American line started to crumple. During this desperate fighting, the American volunteers were supported by some regular Army artillery, some of which was under the command of Lieutenant George H. Thomas, a Virginian who, farther down the road in our story, will forsake his home state, side with the Union, and, in another desperate fight, he'll gain everlasting fame as the Rock of Chickamauga.
As some rattled volunteer units ran away, threatening to leave a huge hole in the American line, the 2nd Illinois Volunteers refused to panic and instead fought a slow, stubborn retreat. Then Braxton Bragg's light artillery came flying up and supported the brave Illinois infantry. Bragg's guns poured round after round of canister fire into the exposed flank of the Mexican column. Stung by the steady fire from the muskets of the 2nd Illinois and flayed by the deadly canister spitting from Bragg's guns, the Mexican advance sputtered to a stop.
But not before some Mexican cavalry, taking advantage of the chaos on this part of the field, swept through and around the American left and then rode hell for leather for Buena Vista, where they would cut off the Americans' line of retreat. It was at this point that Taylor reappeared on the scene, along with Davis and the Mississippi Rifles, the Dragoons, and also some mounted Arkansas riflemen. Taylor sent the Dragoons and the Arkansans galloping back to defend Buena Vista, and then ordered Davis and his Mississippians to launch a counterattack and stabilize the wavering American left flank.
Davis's proud Mississippians, in their red shirts, white duck pants, and their slouch hats, poured several devastating rifle volleys into the stalled Mexicans before they charged, along with the 3rd Indiana, and scattered the enemy infantry. But then 1,500 Mexican Lancers appeared. The menacing Lancers came forward in perfect formation, but for some reason halted when they were about 80 yards away from the Americans. Davis certainly wasn't going to waste the opportunity. He ordered his men to fire, and the Mexicans wheeled their horses and fled for the rear.
Meanwhile, the Mexican cavalry that had ridden for Buena Vista was unable to pierce the hurriedly cobbled-together American defenses, and the Mexicans soon made off to the west, ultimately riding completely around the American army, but accomplishing nothing.
A lull now descended on the battlefield, but by 5 p.m., Santa Anna had rallied enough men that he sent in another massive sledgehammer attack on the American center. Hitting hard and applying overpowering pressure, the Mexicans forced the Americans back. In this bitter fighting late in the day, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Clay, Jr. was killed. Clay's famous father will be familiar to listeners of the podcast from episodes 3 and 4.
Santa Anna was within moments of breaking the American center when Braxton Bragg's flying artillery once again came racing up to a threatened point in the line. Taylor, calmly sitting astride Old Whitey, told the young officer, "Double shot your guns and give 'em hell, Bragg." Well, Bragg loaded his guns with canister and did just that. Jefferson Davis and his rifles, along with some dragoons, came up and provided timely support, and so the last great Mexican assault was thrown back.
Shortly after the shattered Mexican formations withdrew, a heavy rainstorm lashed the battlefield and the day's fighting was over. That night, Santa Anna held a council of war. The overconfident Mexican commander had lost some 3,500 men, killed, wounded, or missing, almost one quarter of his force. The remaining Mexican soldiers were demoralized and exhausted. Across the way, the American losses were 271 killed and 387 wounded. The worn-out Americans held the field, but they were still outnumbered, and Taylor and Wool knew their situation was extremely perilous.
On the morning of February 24th, though, the Americans saw that the Mexicans were in full retreat. Old Zack and General Wool supposedly embraced in the middle of the battlefield and wept like children. They were so relieved. It seems that at the previous night's council of war, Santa Anna, while disheartened by the brutal, inconclusive combat at Buena Vista, decided to brashly declare victory and straightaway leave northern Mexico and return south to the capital, from where he planned to lead a glorious campaign against Winfield Scott's invasion force after it came ashore at Veracruz.
It turns out Buena Vista was the single bloodiest day of the entire war between Mexico and the United States. But then after the battle and Santa Anna's retreat, the Northern Front remained relatively quiet for the remainder of the war. Well, so we spent quite a bit of time this episode covering the Battle of Buena Vista in some detail, and we hope y'all don't mind. But it's such an interesting fight, and was such a near-run thing for the Americans. And of course, Zachary Taylor will go on to trade on his fame and popularity and run for president in the election of 1848. But that's a story for another show.
Well, all right. I know I said last time that this time we'd get to Winfield Scott's march on Mexico City. But obviously that didn't happen since we spent so much time covering other interesting stuff. But I promise that next time we'll definitely get Scott and his army ashore at Veracruz and on their way to the Mexican capital.
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation. Our recommendation for this show is A Country of Vast Designs by Robert W. Mary.
Yeah, the full title is A Country of Vast Designs, James K. Polk, The Mexican War, and the Conquest of the American Continent. And about this New York Times bestseller by Robert W. Perry, Publishers Weekly said, quote, "Using a broad spectrum of published and archival sources, Mary depicts Polk as an unabashed expansionist. His political career was devoted to expanding American power across the continent. Polk saw the fulfillment of manifest destiny as transcending even the festering issue of slavery. Mary makes a strong case that Polk's America embraced a sweeping vision of national destiny that he fulfilled. Mary's conclusion that history turns not on morality, but on power, energy, and will may be uncomfortable, but he successfully illustrates it. End quote.
You can find all of our book recommendations on the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.blogspot.com.
The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is from the song Midnight on the Water and is used by permission of Spiritwood Music. And I think that's it for this week's extra long episode. We want to thank each of you for tuning in and listening to The Civil War, 1861 to 1865, a history podcast. We hope you'll join us again for episode number 7, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.